Hi guys, Dimpna here. I hate negative gearing. You know, it's tax-driven poverty. Now, hate's a very strong word, and I would rather always put things in the positive and say I love positive cash flow. But I guess I had to get your attention nice and early. I believe negative gearing is the single strategy that has kept people from achieving goals, from being able to quit their job, from being able to do all the things in life that they want to do. It is the one thing that has been shoved down our neck since 1985, when things like depreciation and the ability to be able to deduct interest from against an investment property and property losses were able to be deducted against our salaries. And ever since that time, what's that now, you know, 20 odd years ago, our society has been moulded into this state of depression. It really has. You know, this comes to mind because I was talking to one of my students last week. And I was only thinking about her this morning. I thought, you know what? I really want to do this little recording for everybody just to really highlight how this strategy keeps us impoverished. It keeps people in a downtrodden state. It keeps people obedient, if you like, obedient to the cause, whatever the cause is, I suppose. Let's just talk about my student. Now, this couple they were, I guess they were in their early 50s. They'd worked hard, you know, they'd raised two children. Both of them had middle-ish kind of jobs. I think one earned about $55,000. I think the other earned about $65,000. And, you know, they owned a house and they'd bought that house 30 odd years ago, and they progressively paid down the mortgage and redrawn to, you know, buy a car and a few other bits and pieces along the way. And then about, I suppose, 10 years ago, they got caught up with what I call two-tier marketing crowds. Now, that's two-tier marketing is actually something that's illegal, so that's not really what they are. But basically, they're pseudo-educators who sell property. And they sell property in their own developments and they cut deals with other developers to get bulk deals. And typically the prices are inflated anywhere between $40,000 to $50,000. And, you know, there's always a good story behind it about how it's a growth area or it's in a growth corridor and, you know, this shopping centre is going in and that shopping centre is going in. You know, there's always a good story behind it. But if you look a little deeper and if you know anything about economics and you can, you know, which obviously I teach you guys, and you look beyond the superficial, you can see that a lot of these places are going absolutely nowhere. And you start doing a few calculations like grid variance analysis and you know, the depth in the market and all of that sort of thing, which, you know, all my ultimate students know that they know how to do that stuff. You can see that there's a lot of cloak and dagger type stuff behind these sort of properties and behind these kind of people. Anyway, I'm not here to talk about that. What I'm here to talk about is what they ended up getting sold. Now, typical house and land package in the burbs where it's supposedly in this great growth corridor and how it's going to double in value every 5 years or something ridiculous. And, you know, they were just sold on the strategy because I guess they were sitting back thinking, okay, well, you know, we're getting closer to retirement. The kids are getting a little bit older. We've got a little bit of equity in the house. We should start to think about, you know, improving our situation and start to get on to a track of building wealth. You know, we've heard about this property stuff and property sounds like it's something that's a little bit safer than shares. And So that's what they did. Unfortunately, they caught up with the wrong crowd, and they were sold in, first of all, one negatively geared investment property, and how, you know, new property is so much better than everything else because it gives you the opportunity to depreciate more and to claim more as a tax deduction. Well, you know, that's true. And in the sales pitch that they go through, what they say is true. But it doesn't say all the story, and it certainly doesn't look at the big picture of what these people actually wanted. The lady wanted to give up her work. You know, she was getting tired of the job. She had a boss change. She hated the new boss. And she needed to give up work, or she wanted to give up work. She couldn't give up work, of course, because financially they couldn't afford it. And, you know, the gentleman, well, he was okay plodding along for a little bit longer. He had a little bit in superannuation, although not a lot. And their goal was to kick back, have a bit of an easier life. So what were they sold? A negatively geared investment property, house and land package, where, you know, it's the standard four-bedroom, two bath, two garage, the same as every other one in the street, or suburb, and for that matter, and it holds this whole suburb down. We'll talk a little bit more about that and how that works later. But they were sold this, you know, generic variety product. The marketers who were selling her the product was picking up between $40,000 and $50,000 in the process. Whereas if they had been a little bit more educated, they could have gone out and bought the land themselves and built themselves for, well, saving at least the $40,000. And if they were a little bit smarter about design and other things, they could have had something that was 40 to 50 grand under market value from everybody else in that suburb. They could have built something more cost effectively, and they could have built a design that would have given them a better cash flow than the one that they ended up with. But they weren't educated, and they got mixed up with this negative gearing crowd who just wanted to really sell them a property and pick up their 40, 50 grand to throw. So they ended up with this property after the build time, and it took, you know, 6 months, 8 months, 12 months, whatever it did. And the property's negatively cash flowed. By the time you rent it out, there's still a shortfall between what it's actually costing you. Now, there's another major, major downfall in this little strategy here that is sold as being, you know, the salvation to the world and how you're going to be able to retire and all these kind of rot situations, really. I mean, eventually the property will go up in value, but it's going to take a very long time to recover from the $40,000, $50,000 overpricing to start with. And then, you know, markets settling down and the aging of the suburb, and there's a lot of factors that have to come into play before it's ever going to look after itself or an increase in value to any great extent anyway. But the property was negatively cash flowed. Now, what that meant was that they had to put up money. So they had to either find that money somewhere else and work harder to get the money to put towards this property, or they had to cut back on something else. They had to cut back on a lifestyle expense in order to have the money to put towards owning this extra property. But the worst thing as well is they put it in their own name, which of course they were sold as being the right thing to do, because obviously having it in your own name, you can claim it against your salary and offset your tax, and, you know, who wants to pay tax? So yes, let's get out there, negatively gear, lose money on purpose just so that you can save 30 cents in tax. Seriously, think about it. You're on purpose losing a dollar so that you can save 30 cents. That's what negative gearing is. It's as ridiculous as the argument that you hear from the pensioners talking about, oh no, I don't want to make too much money. No, I'll just put it in a low interest saving account because I don't want to make too much money on it because I'll lose my pension. Oh, what? Oh, we won't even go there. But let's get back to negative gearing. They put this thing in their own name. Now, Anyone who's ever seen me speak has heard me talk about asset protection and just how dangerous it is to have properties owned in your own name and to have these properties in available for risk. And most people have got their principal place of residence or the home that they live in their own names. Yet going and putting a second property in their own name, you know, a burglar can break in. They can trip over the fire hydrant in the front lawn and sue you and not only take your investment property, but they'll take your home as well and your boat and your caravan and whatever else you might have. You know, it's not the thing to do. Asset protect, make sure that any litigation that ever comes your way, and believe me, it is far more rampant than you would even possibly imagine. A lot of this stuff doesn't hit the newspapers like it should, you know. Anyway, they had to put in their own name, of course, to get these tax deductions. So they've ended up with a property that is costing them, once you pay for your rates and your insurances and your management fees and all the rest of the stuff, it ends up costing them about $8,000 to $10,000 negative cash flow. Now, you say it in round terms like that, it doesn't sound, oh, that's not too bad. That's $200 a week. Are you kidding me? That's $200 a week that you have to go out and earn somewhere else in order to be able to afford to have this property. Or you cut down on your expenses, you know, your holiday or the second car, or in this people's case, they had a bit of a yen for old motor vehicles, so they put that extra money that was going into something that they both enjoyed into owning this property. And then a little while down the track, of course, the telemarketers hop on the phone and they sell them another one. So not only now are they $8,000 to $10,000 negative cash flow on the first one, but they've got themselves signed up for a second one. It is only $1,000 you have to put down, you know, and we'll go and get a 90% loan for you. And of course, by the time we cross-securitize all your properties and put your investment property and your home and the new investment property all with the one bank, so that you end up having, you're beholden to this bank, and the bank starts telling you what to do and starts being able to dictate terms to you. Well, I don't like being dictated to by anybody, but particularly from a bank who probably knows less about investing than I do. Anyway, that's what happened. They were cross-securitized. And, of course, when you sign a mortgage with a bank, there's a clause in there called the All Monies Clause. And the All Monies Clause basically says that they can come and take any property that the bank has a loan with. Now, the bank manager will often say to you, oh, no, it's not cross-securitized. Definitely not. You know, it's a separate loan and all the rest of it. Absolute rot. Garbage. That is not the case at all. As soon as you have more than one loan with one bank, those properties are cross-securitized. Now, obviously, if you've got a lot of properties, you can't go and have, each property with a different bank because, well, in Australia, there's simply not enough banks for most people. So you end up having a group of properties with this bank and a group of properties with that bank, and you start to spread yourself around that way. But that's at the bigger end of the scale. These guys, they only had three properties. And, of course, true to form, they paid $40,000 to $50,000 over price on the first property and on the second property, I mean. And they borrowed 110%, 115% by the time they paid all their fees and charges and mortgage insurances and all the rest of the stuff that had to come into play to buy this property. And, of course, it's negative cash flow, the second one. So another $8,000 to $10,000. So suddenly you're somewhere between $15,000 to $20,000 negative cash flow a year. That's a big chunk out of these guys' wages, particularly considering the $55,000 and $65,000 that they get is gross. They're gonna pay tax out of that. Now sure, the negative gearing reduces that tax a bit and, you know, puts a little bit back in their refund check. But remember, it's your money in the first place. And it's money that you're effectively losing. Now, by the time these guys came to me, And I was, you know, chatting to them about their circumstances and what they wanted to achieve. When I said to him, okay, well, what are your goals? What do you want? The first thing that came out of their mouth was that she wanted to quit her job and she wanted to have an easier life. She wanted to be able to be, in her words, financially secure, financially free. And that was the whole purpose of them getting out there and buying these two negative cash flow properties. Now, these two negative cash flow properties basically ruined these guys. It meant that all of the equity that was in their home has now been used up as in cross-securitization, cross-collateralized with buying these two investment properties. The market, of course, has gone into a not really a slump, but it's slowed and gone flatline. But the market in these particular suburbs has dropped because the marketeers have pulled out. They've moved on. Those people who have bought the property pop them on the market, and they haven't got the marketing machine behind them to sell these properties. The market's dropped, and guess how much it's dropped by? Surprise, surprise! It's dropped by that $40,000 to $50,000 that these properties were marked up by. Because when you look at these new house and land developments, unless you're riding the marketing dollar of the estate builder and you're getting in at level one on the estate, not level eight when the thing's already sold out, and that's typically when you're buying into through the multi-level. Oh, they're not multi-level marketers. I don't know what to call them really, but they're negative gearing specialists, and they go and cut bulk deals with the developers of the land, or sometimes they develop them themselves. And, you know, they cut a deal to get their margin with the developer, and it's usually at the end of the development stage, and they can sit back and say, oh, this area has had such and such growth, and, you know, this is happening and that's happening, all the rest of it. But by the time you come on board, by the time these investors came on board, any growth that was in those suburbs gone. As soon as the marketeers pull out, the prices drop $40,000 to $50,000, because you can go and buy the land and you can build a house for $40,000 to $50,000 cheaper. So of course the market levels out to the cost of production. So they've got these properties that are now not worth what they paid for them, and they're certainly not worth what they borrowed, because not only, say it was a $400,000 house, well, they might have borrowed $425,000, $430,000, because to pay for the insurance, the mortgage insurance, if they had to, you know, they were borrowing over 80%, and the fees and the charges and the stamp duty and the fees to the marketeers and all the rest of the stuff gets added in there. So they've borrowed, they might have paid $400,000 for it. They could have built it themselves if they'd known what to do for, say, $360,000 and maybe less. They've borrowed $450,000. So it's like, okay, there's that much gone already. And then the market falls from $400,000 down to, say, $360,000, which is where the market should have been resting and where they could have bought in. Now, suddenly, if they go to sell it now, they're $70,000 behind the eight ball. You know, $70,000 is a loss that they're going to take, less the commission, so let's call it $80,000 by the time, you know, if they pull out of that property. And the thing is, they've got two of them. So they're stuffed. They're absolutely stuffed. They can't move forward. They've run out of equity to be and serviceability to be able to go and buy something that will do the right thing by them. If they sell these two properties, they're $70,000 to $80,000 down the tube. You know, what do they do? Well, this is a very typical sad situation that I see all the time. And just like many other of my students, they said to me, oh, I wish I'd met you 10 years ago. I wish I had a dollar for everybody who's ever said that to me. Because there's just, you know, in that typical little story that I see over and over again, there are just so many mistakes. And the thing is, those mistakes can be easily overcome. They can be overcome with education. They can be overcome with knowledge. They can be overcome by having a support network around you to be able to throw questions into the ring and have them answered, to be able to really understand the process behind, to really get economic analysis and grid variance analysis and to really get, you know, a financial model and have a business plan that you've helped develop to make to run forward, not a plan that makes fees for managed fund operators or marketeers selling another development site. You can see I'm pretty wound up this morning, and I'm recording this at about 4 a.m. because I always get up early, but this morning I seem to be up exceptionally early, and I thought, well, you know what, I'm going to go down there, I'm going to talk about one of my pet hates, and I'm going to talk about one of my biggest passions and the biggest loves of my life, which of course is positive cash flow. Now, let me finish this story for you. I want to talk to you about what we actually did. And these are students of mine, and you know they've come to me to have a bit of extra help as to where to go to, because they really were in a tough spot. So, looking at their situation, the best thing for them to do was to actually cut their losses. The suburbs that these guys were in suburbs that weren't going to move in value for at least 2 years. They were going to see no movement in the price. So they either sat back and accepted their 20-odd grand negative cash flow for the next couple of years before the prices would even start to move. And my estimation of them picking up the extra $70,000 to $80,000 that they were going to have to take as a loss if they sold these properties now would be, you know, for them to get up to what they actually owed on the properties, probably another 5 years, maybe even 7 years, because of the suburbs that these guys had bought in. And they were being sold these suburbs as being the be-all and end-all and the growth opportunity of the century. And even a mild level of economic understanding and training would have taught these guys that there's no way in heck that was ever going to happen. So they bit the bullet. They had to, because copping a $20,000 loss on these two properties through for the next 5 years, that's $100,000. And it's not just $100,000 lost. What they've actually lost is the opportunity cost of being able to invest what equity they did have left into other properties, into other markets, with some decent due diligence and understanding behind them to really move forward and make things happen. So that's what's happening now. I think one of the properties is now sold. And the other one is being sold. Now, step forward a little bit with those two properties sold, with their incomes as they currently are, continuing to work in their jobs as they currently do. What they're now able to do with those two properties sold is have enough equity left. They have still had a little bit of equity left, even though they copped effectively a $140,000 to $160,000 loss across the board on selling those two properties. They've now got the opportunity to go out and make that money somewhere else. They've got the opportunity to buy properties that are positively cash flowed. Wow, what a novel suggestion. Let's go and buy something that actually puts money in your pocket rather than loses money. And these guys have gone to the areas that I've suggested they go to. Though they've actually got a contract on one property now, knowing that they can that they'll be able to buy it because the bank has knowledge of the fact that the other property has got an unconditional contract on it. And so those two properties are out of their hair. They can start to breathe easily. And the property that they've now contracted on to buy is positive cash flow, $8,000 a year. And it's in an area that I believe will do very, very well. And they're in a property that they can force the value on. So they can increase the value of the property by doing things to it. So they've got a triple whammy. You know, they've got a property that they can force the value of and make the property worth more. They're both in positions where they want to get stuck in and be active. So that's fabulous. They've got a property that is positively cash flowed $8,000 a year. And by the time they do what I'm suggesting they do to it over the next couple of years, it will turn into, with current market, about a $40,000 to $50,000 positive cash flow property, and they're in an area that is increasing in value naturally. So, you know, that just that one property, selling those two, biting the bullet, taking the loss, moving it into something that they can do something with, has changed their lives. You know, these guys are different people to the people I saw a few months back. They are positive, they can see things happening, they are in control, and that's a big thing. You know, we as humans have an inbuilt propensity to blame. When things don't go our way, one of the initial reactions that people tend to have is to blame something, you know, to blame an external source, to blame a government, to blame the tax man, to blame the salesman, to blame whatever. But in reality, these guys made those decisions for themselves. They were the ones who signed the contracts. They were the ones who agreed to buy properties that were basically putting a nail in their coffin. But they are also the guys that decided this isn't working. We're going to go and seek some advice on something that might work. And we're going to control it this time round. We're not just going to pass it off to somebody else to make that happen for us. And, you know, that's what I'm all about. I'll teach you how to fish. I won't give you fish. I will never sell you a property. That's not what I do. It's not something that I agree with for anybody in my situation, where I'm telling you how to do things. I'm teaching you. I'm educating you. I think it would be fundamentally wrong and immoral for me to sell you a property. If I'm selling a property, there's a reason why I'm selling it. You know, if I'm selling a property, you don't want to buy what I'm selling, I can tell you. So, you know, it's something that you really need to be wary of. These guys have a future. And the reality is that in, well, probably 12 months, maybe 18 at the outside, the wife can retire. She can quit the job that she hates, tell the boss that she hates to stick it, and she will have achieved her goal that she'd so desperately wanted some 10 odd years ago, but went down the wrong path. Now, I call negative gearing the dark side. Have you been on the dark side? And now she's seen the light, if you like. She has. They both have. But she is so enthused because she's the one who's going to give up work first. And what that means is, does she retire and sit home and knit? No. Now that she has seen what really can be done and how quickly not only her life has turned around, but everybody else's in the program that, you know, she's mates with and talks to and catches up with on a regular basis and all of that kind of stuff, they're doing similar things. You know, they're making things happen for themselves, and it's a totally different atmosphere when you've got that support network around you and you've got the ability to hang with people who are proactive, who are positive, who are out there kicking goals, as opposed to sitting by the water fountain and whinging. And it's just a different energy level. It's a different way of living, and these guys are now experiencing that, and they're seeing just how quickly things can turn around when you operate from that level. When she does quit her job and say, "I've had enough. I don't need this money anymore." She'll be in a situation where she can now devote a year, basically, you know, the year that she was earning her $55,000, she will have replaced that income, And she will now have that whole year to put towards making another $50,000 passive income the year after. Now, that's the great thing about passive income, and it's why, you know, it just makes such a difference between, you know, from buying something that's positive cash flow to buying something that's negative cash flow, is that you make it once, you get that passive income happening once, and then next year it happens regardless. It's not like when you go and, you know, you do a renovation, or what I call a chunk deal, where you go and you force the value of the property in you, it doesn't have to be a renovation, it could be a subdivision, could be anything, but you get out there and you increase the value of your property. Now, if you liquidate that property and sell it, you make a chunk of money, and that's great. And you go, wow, you know, I just made $40,000. I made $50,000. I made whatever. And you might go and spend a bit on a reward and go on a holiday to Fiji or Europe or somewhere and you know, pay down the mortgage with the rest of it. And you go, wow, that was really good. But now you come back from your holiday and you sit back and go, okay, now I've got to go and make another $40,000, $50,000. Because you've made the money, you paid the taxes, it's gone. But when you make a passive income, you've still got the asset. You've still got the underlying asset that produces you that passive income year after year after year after year. You know, it's fabulous. And it continues on. It's a legacy. It's something that actually doesn't even have to be sold. You know, it's something that you can pass down to your kids and your grandkids and your whatever's thereafter, your descendants, because it produces that income every year. Now, there may be times when it's advantageous to do things to the property, to improve the property, to increase its density, to increase its yield, all sorts of things. There will be that over time. But as it sits there, you know, it's something that you don't have to go and make again. You've got it the first year, and then every year after that, it produces at least that amount of money. So if you use that time the second year to go and produce that amount of money again, well, from that year onwards, you've then got double the amount of income coming in. Let's just have a think about the reality of getting out there and making $1,000 a week passive income. Do you think that's possible to do for somebody who's got, you know, a little bit of equity, maybe? Guys like these two that I was talking to, with a little bit of equity to go and do that in a year? Do you think that's possible? Well, you know, it's an interesting thought, because I know from reality, from experience, from seeing my students doing over and over again, that it's not only possible, but depending on your starting position, that could be possible inside 3 months. I was, in contrast to these guys who got trapped into the negative gearing poverty cycle, I was talking to another one of my students who, I think in the last, I'm just trying to remember the time frame now, but I think it was over the last, say, 7 months, they have gone from a negative gearing, depressed situation of not being able to have the serviceability to be able to go and buy a property, a home for themselves in Melbourne, because they were negatively geared and it was just so so depressing that the bank wouldn't even lend them any more money to go and buy a home that they wanted in Melbourne. So they took similar kinds of decisions to get out there and use what equity they did have left to get out and buy positive cash flow properties. And inside 7 months, they have accumulated over $150,000 in passive income. Imagine that. 7 months, 150 grand passive income. Now, of course, now that they're not negative gearing, they're now in a situation where the bank's going to lend them any money they want to go and buy their principal place of residence in Melbourne. It's an amazing turnaround once you start to make those decisions, once you start to get yourself on a proper business planning track, to get yourself to a position where you know what you want, number one? I mean, I can't tell you that. That's something you've got to come up with yourself. You've got to decide on what you want and where you want to go and what kind of position you want to be in, what space of time and those sorts of things. But after that, you know, it's education. It's applying that education. It's having that support team around you. It's having people around you who say, don't go and buy it in your own name. Put it into a protected structure so at least you won't get sued. You know, don't go and cross-securitize. No, don't go to that bank. Go to this bank. This is how you set it up. You know, having those lawyers and the accountants and the financial strategists who actually know what they're talking about and are not making money out of selling you some house and land package in the burbs that is 40 to 50 grand under value. And it's the same as every other house in that burb. Oh dear, I am being a little bit cynical this morning, aren't I? But the fact is, it's something that I have seen ruin so many people's lives over my career. And I go back to when negative gearing and depreciation and all of that kind of stuff really became vogue in the mid-80s. And I was out practicing, believe it or not, in the mid-80s. I might have only been newly practicing, but I was out practicing in accounting in the mid-80s. And it was the thing to do. And, you know, I've been a certified financial planner in the past. And, you know, I've owned my senior partner, my own accountancy practice. And I've been an advisor to some of the wealthiest people in Australia, and I have had the words come out of my mouth, negative gearing is the thing to do, all those years ago, and it's not. It wasn't until I went through a little bit of pain myself, in financial pain I'm talking about, where, you know, I had to start all over again from divorce and a business partner ripping off two of my clients for $555,000, $54,000. And I made the decision to repay that money myself. You know, they're tough times, and it really makes you sit down and think, okay, well, what's going to work? You know, I'm doing everything right. I've got my accountancy practice under control. My money management as good as ever going to get. I'm doing everything that everybody's ever told me to do. Why aren't I getting ahead? You know, I'm picture perfect textbook. I'm perfect money manager, all this kind of stuff. Why the hell can't I get ahead? Why can I not see any other road than 25 years down the track I might be able to retire? When I got small kids to look after on my own, how the heck am I going to do that? And it wasn't until I went through those thought processes myself and actually felt the pain of that, that my logical head came in and go, all right, obviously all this stuff that I've been taught for the last 20 odd years isn't working. You know, negative gearing hurts. I can't afford to buy a negative cash flow property. I can't afford to give up the bread and the milk and everything else that I'm putting onto the table now for the kids. I can't work any harder. I don't have any more hours in the day. So I can't buy a negative cash flow property that everybody else, you know, says that that's the way to get ahead. So I thought, if that's not the way to get ahead, well, what is? And, you know, when I went through that pain myself and I thought about, okay, well, what do I do? It was then, and this was long before positive cash flow was ever talked about, it was then that I thought, you know what, maybe I could find a property that doesn't actually cost me anything. You know, maybe I could get into that. And, of course, that led to a whole raft of understanding and mathematics and due diligence and a whole voyage of discovery that changed my life. And once and fear, you know, conquering that fear to get out there and take the first move. Particularly like for these guys I was talking about before, they had already taken that move. You know, they'd gone over that fear to take the first step and to buy that first property. And they'd made a mistake. So not only did they have to get over the fear of taking action, they had to get over the fear of making the wrong decision again. And, you know, that's a hard call. So for me, it took me six months to actually buy a property. From the time I decided on my strategy and said, right, this is what I'm going to go and do. You know, I can make this work. I've done all the modelling. I've done all the financial analysis. I've spoken to everybody who tells me I'm crazy because why would I want to do that? I'm only going to have to pay tax. You know, why buy a property that's positively cash flowed? You're going to have to pay tax. Good God. Forget the tax. Make the money first. Pay the taxes, reduce the taxes where you can, but make the money first. Why on purpose go out there and lose a dollar so you can save 30 cents? So for me, from the day I made that decision, it did take 6 months before I got over my own fear to get in and buy that first property. And the first property was positively cash flowed. On top of that, I actually had to do it without any money, which was an interesting exercise in itself. But that's for another day, not for today. I really just wanted to have a little chat to you about this negative gearing process and how it really is. It's tax-driven poverty. That's what it is, tax-driven poverty. And it's, you know, it's keeping a lot of Australians in jobs they don't like. It's causing depression. It's causing marriage breakups. It's, you know, it's one of the major causes of financial stress in this country. And it still astounds me that there are people out there promoting negative gearing and saying, oh, you know, when the property goes up, you just go and use the equity and go and buy another negative cash flow, and you end up with 1, 2, 3, 4, and you might be 50, 60 grand negative cash flow. And they say, oh, don't worry about it. You'll just go back to the bank and borrow against it, you know, to live on, live off your equity. Even if the thing does go up in value, living off the equity is the most dangerous strategy that you can take on board. And it reminds me of another student of mine that she came to me about 2 years ago. No, it wouldn't be that long. It would have been about a year, year and a half ago. And she told me her story, and she had followed that model. You know, she was working with one of these groups that sell negative cash flow properties, and they're all brand new house and land packages in the burbs. And she'd ridden a growth wave where the properties had gone up in value. You know, they'd counted the 40, 50 grand that she'd bought them over market value and then moved above that. But then, of course, the market slowed. The GFC came along and money became tight and she couldn't reborrow against her equity. She couldn't service the loan. She had 18 of these properties, you know. And to an outsider, they'd think, wow, you know, she's doing really well. Look at the car she drives. You know, she's got 18 properties. Wow. 18 properties that every single one of them was negative cash flow. Imagine paying the mortgage on that. You know, where you're 180, 200 grand a year, negative cash flow. And the only way that she was paying the mortgages was that she'd set up lines of credit against the equity because they had gone up in value. But as soon as the market turns, the banks aren't going to lend her any money. The equity gets chewed up very, very quickly. And I'm very sad to say, but this lady went bankrupt. Because she followed that model. That model doesn't work. That model works for a limited time in a high growth market, but it doesn't work in any other market any other time. So why put yourself in such high risk scenario to deal with that when you could go out and have an easy life? I call it the easy road, Charlie road. You know, take the easy road, take the easy path. You don't have to take the hard path, and negative gearing is certainly a hard path, and it's a rocky road that for many people leads to destruction, depression, and all sorts of horrible things. So guys, I guess that's enough of my rambling this morning. I do hope you heed my comments. It's a very serious comment about negative gearing. It is something that in very limited circumstances, it has its place. But it is overused and it is crippling the general public. You know, the investing public of Australia is being crippled by negative gearing. And this last period of the GFC and the slowing of the economy and the tightening of the monetary system with the banks and all of those sort of things has really emphasized again just how right I am, and that this is not the road to take. There are better roads to take, and the way to find the right path for yourself is via education. Get out there, get educated, get knowledgeable, know how to do the calculations, know how to do due diligence, know how to do your variance analysis, know how to put that business model together, know about finance and structure and asset protection and tax and legal issues. You know, really get yourself in a secure, educated position. I had to laugh the other day. I was one of my students stood up and she was talking about just how far she'd come. And this is a lady who, in her words, is what does she call herself? She's not good with numbers. I can't remember what she calls herself. She's got a name for the fact that she doesn't like numbers, and she takes time to do the maths and the calculations and things like that. And she stood up and she said that she was talking to her brother. And now this lady's been a student of mine for probably 4 years. And she'd been talking to her brother who'd done no financial education at all. And she was so proud of herself because she always looked up to her brother and how she always considered him to be so much smarter than she was. And when she was talking to her brother about, you know, investing and they were going to go and do some stuff together, she was shocked, horrified, and amazed at how much she knew in comparison to her brother, who she had always put up on a pedestal as being, you know, so much better than her mathematically and all of those sort of things. And she just knew so much more. And she stood up and she was talking to a group of, I don't know, about 50-odd people. And she said, you know, that she wanted to thank me about taking her on that journey and for everybody in the room to acknowledge just how far they had come and just how much of a difference that education had made in every facet of their lives. And it's true, you know, education is something that I believe very, very strongly in. And it is the path to freedom, financial freedom, you know, to be able to live the life you want to live, to be able to do the things you want to do, to be able to be in a position where you're in control. And if you want to go to the beach today, you go to the beach. If you want to go to work, you go to work. You know, it's the ability to be able to be proactive and really control your own destiny. So on that thought, I'm going to leave you with that this morning. Think about what I've said and really step up to the plate. Guys, if you've been to some of my Ultimate Stuff before and that sort of thing, come back. Come back, get re-enthused. There's places around Australia that I go through that I talk about that I believe will double in value over the next 3 to 5 years. There are places that are yielding positive cash flow that will replace your income in very short spaces of time. It's just a matter of getting that knowledge together to work out the price points and the logic and the business plan behind your personal situation and what you have to do to make that happen. So guys, thanks heaps for listening to me this morning, and I'll be back again to talk to you very soon. Bye for now.